Hi, I'm Kenneth Johnson, the creator of the Bionic Woman and the Incredible Hulk television series, and you are listening to Comic Book Central, where comic books come to life.
Welcome, comic book fans. This is Comic Book Central. I'm your host, Joe Stuber. Thank you for joining me today. It is another big day here in the lair. You know, growing up, three of my favorite television shows were The $6 Million Man, The Bionic Woman, and, as you could probably guess, The Incredible Hulk. Who as a kid in the 70s didn't run around in slow motion going, na 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 na? You know, the Bionic duo were fantastic, and at least twice on Friday nights, I knew I was going to get to see David Bruce Banner's eyes go green as he hulked out on my TV set. Terrific, terrific stuff. And going back now, watching the DVDs, makes you realize that there was so much depth to those characters and episodes. And for that, we can thank today's guest on Comic Book Central, Kenneth Johnson. Kenneth Johnson is one of the most prolific writer, producer, directors in Hollywood. Over the course of four decades, he has created and produced some of the most iconic series and miniseries in television history. His work on the cyborg action drama The $6 Million Man, starring Lee Majors, led directly to the creation of Steve Austin's bionic complement, Jamie Summers, played by Lindsay Wagner. Ratings soared once Jamie started tossing the bad guys around, so Kenneth was asked to create the companion series, The Bionic Woman, yielding more blockbuster ratings. Kenneth's realistic approach to superhuman beings was put to the greatest test when he was offered his choice from a news rack full of Marvel comic book characters. The tragic and tortured nature of the Incredible Hulk stood out to Kenneth, who wanted to stay away from the look and feel of the comic book and go for a more literal take on the character. He even suggested changing the Hulk's color from green to red, reasoning that red is the color of rage. Well, he lost that battle and the Hulk stayed green, but in the process of developing the show, Kenneth crafted not only one of the greatest comic book adaptations of all time, he created an Emmy-winning psychological drama of the highest order, the perfect showcase for the talents of legendary actor Bill Bixby and a brash, bold, and built newcomer named Lou Ferrigno. Kenneth also penned one of the most quoted lines in TV history.
Mr. McGee, don't make me angry. You wouldn't like me when I'm angry.
The seminal miniseries V followed, as did the hit television adaptation of Alien Nation, both projects showcasing Kenneth's gift for allegorical storytelling in superior spectacle. His career spans 40 years and counting. That includes creating, writing, and producing some of the most iconic television shows in history. He is Kenneth Johnson, or as he told me to call him, Kenny Johnson. Kenny, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Joe. I'm delighted to be with you.
Glad to have you. Well, you know, Starlog Magazine's Edward Gross once wrote the following about you. He said, Kenneth Johnson has probably done more for science fiction television than anyone since Gene Roddenberry created Star Trek. What are your thoughts when you hear that?
Well, it makes me want to send Ed Gross another bouquet of flowers, you know. it's very flattering, and Ed's been a good friend and fan over the years, and I very much appreciate what he has said. And to be honest, you know, a number of other people have said sort of similar things, and it's very rewarding and sort of surprising for me, because I mean I never set out to say, boy, I want to be a big creator of science fiction work. It just sort of stumbled into it. And when your first success out here in Hollywood is a science fiction piece like The Bionic Woman, and then they push the Marvel comic superheroes at you, and one of those ends up being successful, then very quickly the pigeon.
Which one would that have been?
Yeah, well, yeah, it's not easy being green. But you know, when that sort of success comes to you, the pigeonhole begins to get smaller and smaller around you. I always tell my filmmaking students that they should be very, very careful what it is that they have as their first success, because that's what Hollywood will want you to do over and over and over again forever. And so it's been incredibly rewarding, and we'll talk about the beauty of working in allegorical fiction and speculative fiction. But I always envision a much more eclectic career, because I was trained in the classic theater at Carnegie, what is now Carnegie Mellon University. It was then
you went to Pittsburgh.
Yes, I was in Pittsburgh. It was when I was there, it was still Carnegie Tech. It was before the Mellons came aboard. I've never quite gotten used to Carnegie Mellon. It sounds like something you have for breakfast with prosciutto, you know.
Did you ever start saying yins?
No,
but you know what that is.
What is that?
Oh, okay. Well, that's the area I'm from originally, so that's our vernacular some say y'all, but you know.
One of the things I remember about walking across the campus at Carnegie in 1960 was suddenly in the middle of the afternoon on this October day, there was this extraordinary shout of about 50,000 people going, yeah! And it was, I believe, Roberto Clemente hitting the home run that won the series for the Pirates, and that was in Forbes Field, which was about 5 miles away. But it sounded like they were going to have an alien invasion at any moment.
Well, that's Pittsburgh sports.
But I was trained in classic theater at Carnegie, from the Greeks and the Romans through Shakespeare and into the 20th century, and always envisioned having a rather eclectic career that would sort of use that classic training as the underpinning for it, and I think actually that's what did happen, even though I ended up doing more sci-fi or becoming more well known for doing sci-fi than anything else, but it's been very rewarding, and I'm very happy to have people like Ed say such nice things about my work, which was also accomplished with the enormous help of the people who I tried to surround myself with. I always tried to hire people that were smarter than I was, Joe.
It's a good plan. Hey, how did you break into television?
Well, it's funny, when I was at Carnegie, there was no film or television at the university. It was strictly a drama school, working in the theater, working on the boards with actors. I was a directing major at Carnegie, so I had a lot of hands-on experience getting performances out of actors, even acting myself, which was part of the curriculum that you had to go through. But in my freshman year, I also had the good fortune of the very first week I was there meeting a young guy named Bill Pence, who was a senior and I discovered was quite a big man on campus. He ran the school newspaper. He ran the school drama group that was not associated with the drama department. But he also ran this little operation called the Film Arts Society. And Film Arts showed a new classic movie every week for like $3. You got to see 14 films during a semester. And they were the greatest films in the history of cinema from around the world. And for the first time, I was exposed to a quality of film work that I had only just touched on briefly a little bit in my senior years at high school. I was one of those guys in high school who would go to movies that had subtitles, but nothing compared to the range of cinema that I saw thanks to Bill. We are still good friends today. Bill, incidentally, created the Telluride Film Festival, which is in its 40th year this weekend, as a matter of fact, Labor Day weekend. So I got extremely interested in film, and by the time I graduated from Carnegie, I had had the blessing of not only the terrific training in Stanislavski and theater from the drama department, but I'd also seen, thanks to Film Arts, about 400 or 500 of the greatest movies in the history of cinema, and I really realized that was the direction that I wanted to go, into filmmaking, and when I first graduated, I went to New York and said, here I am ready to make movies. And everybody said, why did you come to New York? You know, we're not doing it here. And I was already married with a kid and I had to eat. And so I ended up doing some television work first at CBS and then at WPIX in New York, where I was hired as a producer director when I was 21 years old. It was an intimidating experience. Everybody at the whole station was old enough to be my father or my grandfather.
Same kid.
Yeah, I really was. I really was. And shortly after that, I migrated to Philadelphia for a couple of years, where I was seduced by a guy named Roger Ailes, who went on to be the Roger Ailes of Fox News Corp. Into joining the Mike Douglas Show, which was a big talk show out of Philadelphia at the time, nationally.
It was Tiger Woods' first television appearance.
That's right. You're right. Tiger Woods and many, many others. And it was a fantastic place to work, because we did 90 minutes a day live 6 times a week.
Wow.
And everybody in the world came through there, all the big stars, all the big authors, you know, lawyers, politicians, anybody who had anything to push or an agenda was on that show. And I got to do a lot of film work while I was there, too. And I was just about to come to Hollywood and say, OK, now I want to take my shot at really making movies in Hollywood, when Roger decided he wanted to leave the Douglas Show and to produce Mr. Nixon in 1968. And Westinghouse asked me to take over the Douglas Show as the executive producer. I was 24 years old, I think.
Still a kid.
Yeah, I was producing the highest rated. It was the only big talk show in the country. And so I stayed another year to do that, and then finally came out to California and said, okay, here I am, I'm ready to make movies. And Hollywood said, but you're a talk show producer. You know, so
how about some television?
Well, that's it. It's funny. I was sleeping on the couch, literally, of my pal Steve Bochco's house or apartment.
With Hill Street Blues fame.
Well, Steve and I had met when we were in college. He was a year or so behind me. As a matter of fact, when I left the Film Society to Steve to run. And he had preceded me to California and was already working at Universal as a story editor at Universal on shows like Columbo and things like that. And asked me, he said, look, Kenny, you really got to write. That's how you get your foot in the door here. Because, you know, if you're a writer, you can write on spec and maybe somebody will like it enough to let you direct it. If you're an actor, you can do bit parts and work your way up. But if you're a director, which is what I always was primarily, Joe, if you're a director, they either give you the $1 million to do their movie or they don't, you know. And until you've done it for somebody else, they don't want to give it to you. But Steve was a tremendous helpmate and introduced me around to at Universal. I met Steve Cannell, who was a very young guy, also working as a story
editor.
Yeah, oh, terrific. A dear, dear friend until his death. And they both really helped me get connected at Universal. And finally, Steve Bochco introduced me to Harve Bennett, who was producing this show called The $6 Million Man.
I think we've heard of that here.
Yes, it was very early on. It was only in the middle of its second season at that point, and not doing all that great. And they were really desperate for ideas and scripts. And Harve read a screenplay that I had written on spec, and which he liked a lot. Had nothing to do with the Bionic shows, but he's asked me to come in and talk to him about some ideas. And one of the ideas that we kicked around was The Bride of Frankenstein. The idea that he had this monster man with a $6 million man in strange parts and arms and legs. I said, shouldn't he have a mate? Shouldn't he have his own Elsa Lancaster, you know, to be the bride of Frankenstein? And he liked the idea. I wrote the script, and suddenly I was a hero. And the show was extraordinarily successful. Harve asked me to join 6 Mill as a producer. And I said, Harve, you know, bless your heart, thank you, but I really don't want to produce. I said, I'm a director at heart. Let me just write and direct for you. And Harve very quickly set me straight. He said, Kenny, let me explain this to you. In television, the producer is the guy that hires the writer and hires the director. I said, I get it, Harve. I'll take the job, you know. And that's what I did, and I proceeded to hire myself to write and direct.
Smart move.
Yeah, and that's how I managed to get my foot in the door. And for a while, suddenly, the Bionic Woman took 6 Mill into the top 10 for the first time.
That was your first episode that you wrote.
Well, I wrote, it was originally a 1 hour, and Harve and Freddie Silverman, who was running ABC, felt that it was too dense. And I said, well, what do you want me to cut? And they said, no, we don't want you to cut anything. We want you to make it longer. It's going to be 2 hours.
Nice.
I said, but you only have a 1 hour show. And they said, no, it's going to be a two-parter. I don't think anybody had done a two-parter yet at that point. And I was thrilled. I said, do I get paid again? You know, and they said, yeah, because it was the only money I had made all year. And the show was very successful. I had to kill her off at the end of it. I said, no, this is a mistake. We should leave her alive. And they insisted that I kill her off. But so I did. Cerebral hemorrhage. She was very dead. And then when they saw the ratings, we got a great letter from the head of the psychology department of Boston University, who castigated Harv. He said, how dare you create this brilliant young female archetype, this role model for young women, and just toss her away? That's ridiculous. And so immediately, and after looking at the ratings, which were really big, Freddie Silverman came back to us and said, listen, I want you to do the Bionic Woman, bring her back to life.
She had a pulse.
He said, why'd you kill her anyway? That was a stupid idea, you know? And so I brought her back, and the return of the Bionic Woman came on the air in the fall, and it shot 6 million into the top 10 for the very first time, and immediately Freddie, of course, wanted to spin it off into its own series, which we did, and for a while I was writing and producing both shows at the same time, which is not my idea of a good time. It's a bit like living in a garbage disposal. And and it wasn't giving me any time to direct either. And so I finally, after a season and a half or so of The Bionic Woman, said, look, I just really want to break off and do other things that I can, do that will give me more time. And that's when Frank Price, who was running Universal, came to me and said, Kenny, we've just acquired the rights to the Marvel Comics superheroes. Which one would you like to do? And I said, I could see the pigeonhole growing, or shrinking. And
you had a lot going on around that time. But before we get to the big green guy, you talking about the $6 million man, the Bionic Woman wasn't the only classic episode that you're responsible for. I mean, fans of the $6 million man, Bigfoot. We've got you to thank for Bigfoot. Yes. We have Andre the Giant in one episode, Ted Cassidy, who was Lurch, in another episode.
Yeah,
some of those iconic episodes, those are yours.
Yeah, I'd had the idea for Bigfoot was very big in those days, so to speak.
It freaked me out when I was a kid, I'll tell you that.
Well, I know. I loved the idea I was always looking for worthy adversaries for somebody that had the strength and power of Steve Austin. And it occurred to me that it would be really cool if he had an encounter with Bigfoot. And then I thought, wow, what if they did have an encounter? What if Steve pulled his arm off and instead of blood gushing, it was a flurry of sparks? And my wife, Susie, has often said that she does not think I could write any script without a flurry of sparks in it somewhere, even if it's an English drawing room comedy.
Slow motion sparks. Yeah, that's
exactly.
The key.
And I said, well, why would that happen? And it sort of developed from there. And I wrote what became, as you said, one of the iconic episodes. We got Andre to play the lead, which was obviously about the only guy that could do it. And he only spoke French. This was long before The Princess Bride. But he was a wonderful guy and a good, he was terrific to work with. Although Lee Majors was very concerned because Andre had to carry him at one point through this revolving ice tunnel, which is still on the Universal tour. You can still see it. And the problem about the ice tunnel was it looked great visually, but you couldn't stand up in it. You literally fell over whenever those things started turning. And even if you knew what was going on, your brain just went whack. You know, Lee said, Kenny, he's going to drop me on my ass. I know he's going to break my, you know, and I told Lee that I had explained to Andre how to do it. The trick was you don't look out straight ahead. You look down at the floor. If you look down at the floor, you can walk and it's fine. As soon as you looked up, it was all over. But it was a huge episode, and they were great. They also did a Bionic Bigfoot doll.
Yeah, I was going to ask you, did you get the action figure?
No, gee, somehow Universal managed to work it out that I never got a dime from either Bigfoot or from the Bionic Woman doll, which was the outsold Barbie that Christmas. It was amazing. Yep. But, never filtered down, Joe.
Not a cut of that. Well, at least hopefully you got a cut of the DVDs that just came out.
Would you like to buy my share for a dollar? No, but the DVDs were fun to work on and to go back and do the commentaries on.
The premiere episode, the pilot episode, The Bionic Woman, listen to the commentary because I love when producer, director, writers do the commentary. Oh, it's like a film school. You put this thing on and you're just breaking down everything. I love it.
Well, that's what I try to do. I've listened. I hate those commentaries where you just hear a couple of guys that haven't seen the movie in months or years or ever, and now they're looking at it and go, oh, yeah, look, now I'm walking across from the right side to the left side. Yeah, that was a fun day. Wow. You know, it's
that
like,
was a good episode.
It's like, yeah, exactly. It's like, who cares? You know, so right. I figured anybody that wants to take the time to listen to my commentaries wants to get something out of it more than just nonsense. So
it's tremendous. Anybody that go get the DVDs if you don't have them already. Listen to the commentary with Kenneth Johnson. It's amazing stuff. What made you cast Lindsay Wagner for the role of the Bionic Woman?
Well, Harv and I were looking for essentially the girl next door. We wanted a real person and also a real actress. We looked at a bunch of film of a number of women at the time who were quite good and whom we considered. Stephanie Powers, as a matter of fact, who was in the Bigfoot episode, was one of the last candidates. And I think we looked at Sally Field at the time. We just looked at film. We didn't invite them in to read. And then we saw an episode of Steve Cannell's show, Rockford Files, where Lindsay had the lead. She was just a contract player at Universal. But I immediately said, wow, look at the spontaneity. It sounds like she's making up everything as she goes along. It doesn't sound like she's, you know, studied lines and is reciting them. And she said she had this tremendous facility for spontaneity and also for really genuine acting chops that were terrific. And she was pretty but not Hollywood beautiful type. And we believed she was real. And then what I tried to do when we went forward with Lindsay was spend a lot of time with her and listen to Lindsay talking so that I could write the lines and shade the scripts so that they would fit easily into her mouth, and I think that's why it was so successful. Jamie was a wonderful blend of who Lindsay really was and the character that I conceived.
Well, I'll talk about natural acting ability. She won an Emmy for the role, so fantastic, yeah. Fantastic job on her part. As you mentioned, that was one of the few female heroes on television at the time. What message did you want to bring to the show? Did you get a sense of that, and did you try to work with that?
It's funny. I think I was a feminist before there was a word for it. I was raised by a very strong mother who was a career woman. At the same time, she was always there for me in school and stuff when I needed it. But she had a life, and I just saw in her the ability to work in a man's world as a total equal. And so as far as I'm concerned, women have always been the total equal, generally the better of men in many cases. So I didn't set out to do kind of a feminist tract or anything like that, but I just wanted to write a really good character that I really cared about. And I've always enjoyed writing good, strong female characters because I don't think there's enough of them out there. I don't think that, if you look at a lot of my later work too, even on Alien Nation, a lot of strong females in V, certainly, really strong, dominant females, both on the good side and the bad side. And I love writing for women. It's terrific, and I think it's underdone in Hollywood a lot of times.
Well, for those who say there aren't enough good roles for females in Hollywood, they just need to send you an email, because you are probably one of the best writers for female characters, I would imagine. Now, you alluded to it earlier. Things got a little strange, I guess, on the set of Bionic Woman. There's some upheaval. It switched networks. So you had exited the show at one point, you kind of had a nice safety net to go into. The world of the Jade Giant.
Well, it was, you know, the situation was with on the Bionic Woman in a nutshell was that Lindsay, by the second season, had really made the unfortunate choice of surrounding herself with a lot of sycophants, and I was really the only person that was sort of telling it like it was, you know, and being straight with her. And there was also some substance abuse and other things going on at the time, which fortunately she has really turned her life around in a grand way, 180 degrees since then. But at the time, it was you know, I went to Frank, as a matter of fact, and said, I think this train is headed for a cliff, Frank, and I'd really like to get off and get on with something else. And then sort of a short time after that, Lindsay decided that she didn't want to have me on the show. And I said, okay, great, thanks, bye. And so it was, the timing was good. But as I said, then Frank came to me about that same time with
About comic books?
Well, yeah, and he said, well, let's see, we've got the Human Torch and the Man from Atlantis and Captain America and Ms. Marvel. I remember her when she was Mary Marvel. Mm-hmm. And this ridiculous thing called the Incredible Hulk. And, you know, and I just said, gee, Frank, no.
Know about the character? I mean, like, were you familiar with the comic book?
Not at all.
Okay.
Most people weren't, actually. It was not one of Marvel's big hits until after we did the series. They had made a couple of stabs at it, but it had never taken off like Spidey and some of the other ones did. But I just wasn't interested in doing any of it, Joe, because I could see myself going down a road that I didn't want to become the superhero guy all of a sudden. But Susie, my wife, probably the most literate woman I know, except for our daughter, Katie, who is a good match, had given me a copy of Les Miserables to read, which I had never read. And I was in the midst of it, and I had Jean Valjean and the fugitive concept and Inspector Javert pursuing him, all of that in my head. And I remember sitting at home, because I was literally sitting at home trying to say, how can I tell Frank politely that I don't want to do any of these comic book things? I didn't want to get involved with Captain America and stuff because I just don't deal with spandex colors and primary colors. But so I had the fugitive thing in my head and the Jean Valjean, Les Miserables thing in my head. And I realized, oh, God, okay. Well, I guess there's a way to take a little bit of Victor Hugo out of Les Miserables, a little bit of Robert Louis Stevenson's Jekyll and Hyde, and do something with this ludicrous thing called The Incredible Hulk. But that was a challenge because I had to fight a lot of battles. But ultimately, I went to Frank and said, okay, look, I'll do it. If it can be done my way, if it's my casting, so I don't have to put up with people looking over my shoulders, you just leave me alone and let me do it. And also, I want something in return. And Frank said, sounds good, Kenny. What would you like in return? Frank's cards were always very close to his vest, you know. And I said, well, I don't think Sir Walter Scott's Ivanhoe has ever really been given the treatment it deserves, a big, splashy, four-hour miniseries or something of knighthood and chivalry and jousting, and Robin Hood is one of the principal characters and all that. I said, sounds good, Kenny. I'll do The Incredible Hulk, and we'll do Ivanhoe. Okay, Frank shook hands on that. And I wrote the pilot for The Incredible Hulk in 7 days, the whole screenplay, top to bottom, in 7 days. And we went into production right away. I sent the script to Bill Bixby, the only actor I ever thought of for the role. When he got the script that said The Hulk on it, I couldn't even bring myself to write The Incredible Hulk on the end of the title. It was just too ridiculous. And so it was just called The Hulk. And his agent sent it to Bix, and Bill said, I'm not going to read a script called The Hulk. And his agent said, yes, you are. and he read it, and Bix called me the next day and said, can I come see you right now? And I said, well, sure, come on over. And so he came to my office at Universal, and Bill was like a force of nature. I always say that Bill walked into the room like the first 8 bars of Tiger Rag. It was like, boom, you know, when he walked in. And he said, is this what we're going to do? Is it going to be a drama? Is it going to be cursed? Is it going to be tragic? I said, yes, yes, yes.
Total commitment.
Exactly. And he said, will you stay with the show as long as I do? And somehow the thoughts of Faust, you know, became going through my head. And I thought, okay, I guess I have to say yes. So I said yes. And we shook hands. And that was that. And it was, we went on from there. It was good.
One of the greatest pilots ever shot.
Thank you.
Would people like you when you're angry?
Well, I don't get angry really very often. But
you don't Hulk out on the set?
No. It's funny about that line, though. And I know maybe you heard me say this somewhere along the line. I know I've said it a couple of times on camera interviews. The line when Bill says it, and it was in the main title of The Hulk, of course, every week, Mr. McGee, don't make me angry. And when we're on the set, what you're seeing in that, when you see that line, you're seeing take 2. And because in take 1, Bix came out and he was playing it angry. Mr. McGee, don't make me angry. I said, wait, cut, stop. And I went up to him and I said, Bix, it's a joke. He said, ah, you know. And then he went back and came out and did it the way that we've, you know, that became iconic with that little twinkle and smile on his face. And
It's used in the movies. It's used in comic books now. It's continually referenced 35 years later.
I know. It's amazing. It turns up all the time. Family Guy has done several things about it, and it's been questions on Jeopardy and, you know, and all of that stuff. And it's funny, when they did the motion picture, the first Hulk movie, which was really abysmal, unfortunately. One of the writers called me from New York, a cold call. I didn't know the guy. He said, you know, there were 10 writers that worked on this movie for 12 years trying to get it made. And he said, I went to a screening, and the only line that the audience reacts to in the whole screening was that, don't make me angry, you know. And which was sort of gratifying and ironic to hear. But at the premiere, which was, you know, the first movie was directed by Ang Lee, for whom I have great respect. He's a tremendous director, of course. But some clever pundit walked up to me after the screening and said, Mr. Johnson, don't make me Ang Lee. You wouldn't like me when I'm Ang Lee. And it was...
The line still has legs.
That's right.
Hey, what was your take on the characters of Banner and the Hulk?
Well, to me, I saw it, again, going back to my classic training, what I saw was really the basic Greek tragedy, where the hero is felled by his own hubris, that wonderful Greek word meaning false pride or overconfidence, we might say. Because that's exactly what was happening here. Dr. David Banner was tampering with things better left to the gods. And when you do that in Greek drama or in The Incredible Hulk, you got to pay the price. And what the price he had to pay was he brought this curse down upon himself. So the whole premise of the show was to make the show go away, which perhaps was subtext for how I felt about doing a show based on a comic book. But and I think that's the reason that it struck a chord. I think certainly all of us have felt that visceral anger rise in us. I mean, look at what happens on highways in Los Angeles that we call road rage. We've all felt that moment where you just want the inner child to break out of you and go smashing things up. And I think partly that is why the show was so successful, because everybody connects to that your gorge rising in anger. And partly it was because of the brilliant performance that Bix gave throughout all 88 hours of television that we did. And certainly it was because of the writing staff that worked with me through those years and created some extraordinary episodes. Certainly Jack Colvin brought a tremendous perspective to the piece, too, and depth. And we never set out to do a show for kids. This, in my head, was always a deep psychological drama. And I think that's why we won, we were nominated several times for Emmys, and Mariette Hartley won the Best Actress Award.
For Married,
yes. And that was, you know, it was tremendously rewarding. And I still get letters today and emails by the hundreds from people all over the world that were touched by it, because they understood that what we were trying to do on the show was consistently play the theme of what is the Hulk inside this character? What makes this episode an episode that really should only be on the Hulk? Because we tried to examine the fact that the Hulk, the monster, the demon, is really the enemy within, and different people have different Hulks, different kinds of demons. In Banner, it was anger that brought it out. In other people, as in my parents, it was alcoholism. In other people, it could be lust or greed or any number of underlying emotions that was the Hulk inside them. We even did a show with my friend Tommy Madden, who was a little person. We did an episode about him who hated the fact that he was a dwarf and didn't want to, you know, and it was, so that was his Hulk coming out. And I think it was, and I think that's why all of the stuff that I've done in science fiction has been as successful as it has, Joe, because I've always looked for the underlying substance that this can be built upon. I find that I'm much more interested in relationships and emotional connection and character than I am in the latest CGI techniques or science fiction stuff. Or V was never about alien people and reptiles and spaceships and stuff. It was about power. It was about, the theme of V was power. And what happens when an extraordinary hyperpower suddenly comes into your life, like the Nazis rolling into the Low Countries in World War II and saying, "Hi, we are the Nazis, we are the new guys here, we're here to be your friends and to protect you from the English," you know? And it intrigued me to do a piece about how everyday people would respond to a sudden sea change in their life. When such a power came to be, how some people would suck up to it, like the Vichy French did to the Nazis in World War II. Some people would just try to keep their heads down, thinking, "Oh boy, if I just stay low enough, maybe they won't bother me." And some people, of course, say, no, this power is being abused and we have to fight back against it. And they become the heroes of the resistance. And so that's what intrigued me about it. And I think that's why the show was so successful. Alien Nation the same way. Fox called me... So we'd like you to take a look at this movie, Alien Nation. And I said, I don't want to look at anything that has the word alien in it, you know? Because by then I had done V and I thought it was sort of, I just didn't want to go there. But I saw very quickly, they thought they had Lethal Weapon with aliens. And I realized what I could do was an updated version of In the Heat of the Night. I could do a piece that was about prejudice, that was about intolerance, that was about discrimination, and chip away at that some more, as I've tried to do through my whole career. I was raised in a very bigoted, anti-Semitic household, and I just never bought into it, and I just didn't get it. And Alien Nation was a wonderful opportunity to sort of, you know, chip away against it.
A lot of subtext to your projects. What did Bill Bixby and Lou Ferrigno bring to the series of The Incredible Hulk?
Well, Bix was, of course, a master actor. And sometime if you have never had an opportunity, you should Netflix or take a look at a PBS drama play that Bill did back in about 1973 called Steam Bath. It's about a group of people, himself, Valerie Perrine, and a few other people.
It's a British series, right?
No, it wasn't a series. It was just a one-off. Yes, this was way before the series. The series was 1977, 78. But Steam Bath was a PBS play that he did with my friend Norman Lloyd, and about people in this steam bath, except they begin to realize there's no way out of this steam bath, and where are they? And it turns out it's purgatory. And the little Puerto Rican steam bath attendant who is going around and looks like comic relief is really God. And in that hour and a half, 2 hour play, you see Bill Bixby go through every single emotion and level and character that a human being can go through. And it's so stuck in my mind that when I wrote the script for the Hulk, I had Bix in mind even while I was writing it. And he was the first guy and the only guy I sent it to.
And how about Lou Ferrigno?
Louis was not my first choice. Richard Kiel was my first hire, as a matter of fact, for the Hulk. I wanted an actor, not a muscle man. I wanted somebody that could play the role like Boris Karloff had in Frankenstein, and who had acting chops. And we hired Dick because he was, and also was big. I mean, Dick was 7'5", and there was no kidding that he was big, but he wasn't muscular, obviously. And after about a week of filming, we all just sort of said, you know, as great as an actor as Dick Kiel is, and he went on to be Jaws, of course, the steel-toothed guy in the Bond films, and have a great career.
You can actually see him in the pilot too, right? There's a shot.
It's one shot. Yeah, there's only one shot in the pilot. It's when he's out at the lake and about to push the tree down on to save the little girl who's drowning in the lake. And there's a shot from the top of the tree looking down that was extraordinarily difficult to get. And when we went back and reshot everything with Lou, I just didn't have time to get the camera up that high again. And so Dick is in that one shot. But
it seemed to me like Lou really brought a pathos to the role, just a sort of a humanity to this beast.
Well, he did. Louis grew into it, and very quickly. I had read him prior to hiring Dick, and I didn't hire him at the time because He just had no acting experience. He was a 24-year-old out-of-work sheet metal worker who was a bodybuilder, you know, and a brilliant bodybuilder, Mr. Olympia or whatever it was. But he was not an actor. And so I said, yeah, well, he looks great, but, you know. So so I went back again and read him a second time. And it was hard to read because, of course, he doesn't have any lines. He's just got to do it all in silence, and except for roaring occasionally.
Was there ever thought to have the Hulk speak on the show?
No, Hulk not speak. Hulk talk is dumb. You know, Hulk talk sound dumb. Hulk smash. No kidding. We see the Hulk smash. And I realized, you know, that we were going to very quickly get into the food good, and, you know. And
fire bad.
Yeah, fire bad. Hurt. No kidding. You know, and
well, thank you for not then.
Yeah, no. It was right from the beginning. There was never a thought that I was going to have him speak because I didn't want to do that. But I did some improvisational work with Lou in that second audition, and as a matter of fact, I died in his arms like Susan Sullivan did later on, lying on the floor of my office. And he, you know, I thought, okay, I think I can make this work. I think I can get enough to make it work. Will it work for the series? I don't know. But Louis, I think, surprised all of us and really grew into the role very, very quickly, and was always a dream to work with. And it was a very difficult life for Louis because not only was he acting and having to get in and out of makeup, all that stuff, but he had to work out 4 hours a day in order to keep that body. So he was really working hard, and he did a great job, and we're still good friends till this day. We had dinner just a couple of months ago again, and we see each other occasionally, and he's a terrific guy, and I think that he really captured it, in spite of the fact that I could never get a wig that didn't look like the Three Stooges. That just made me
except the pilot. I thought you nailed it in the pilot.
Oh, I was never happy, you know.
He looked amazing in the pilot. I watched it again recently, and Lou looked unbelievable in it.
It was a challenge. It's, you know, but we had a great time.
All those things came brilliantly together. I'd be remiss if I didn't ask you about another comic book property with Shaquille O'Neal as Steel. You wrote and directed, produced by Quincy Jones. Again, the appeal of the project. What appealed of that project? What was the appeal for that?
My friend Joel Simon and Bill Todman had brought me a project a few years earlier that they really wanted to do for television. It was called The X-Men, oh that. And this was long before Bryan Singer came into the scene. I said, gee, guys, I think this could be a really cool concept, but you cannot afford to do it right on television. It ought to be a big movie or something. And then, you know, eventually it became a big movie. And I think Bill and Joel got executive producer credit or something on it because they had they had sort of gotten the ball rolling. And I thought Brian did a brilliant job in pulling it off. I was very, very pleased by what I saw. But Joel was working with Quincy Jones, and so I got a call from Quincy and Joel one day saying, look, we got this movie we want to do. We want you to write and direct it for Warner Brothers. It's a go picture. And it's about, and they told me what it was, you know, there was a, not really a superhero, just a real guy that creates this armor for himself, sort of a poor man's Iron Man, if you look back at it. And it had a black hero. And this was before there had been a black superhero or anything. It really appealed to me. The idea of doing a character that would be a role model for young black guys. And I said, that's great. Who's going to star? And they said, well, we got Shaquille O'Neal attached to play the lead. And I said, that's great. Who's going to star? You know? And he said, well, Shaq can open the movie. I said, no, he can't. Shaq, you know, I mean, he's very nice in Kazam and in a couple of other little small things he'd done. But I said, he's not going to open the picture for you. He said, no, well, you know, let's just talk, you know, just let's get going on it, and then we'll talk about it some more. And so I jumped into it and wrote the script very quickly. The Warners was very happy with. And all through the whole pre-production process, Joe, I'm saying, fellas, you know, you got to put some big names around this guy because he's not going to carry or open the picture.
Even Donner knew that with Superman.
Well, of course, yes, yeah. Right. You know, you put Gene Hackman in it, and suddenly you got a movie. You put Marlon Brando.
There you go.
You know, and I said, look, just give me a. Why did they? I said to Warner's, why did you guys put Arnold Schwarzenegger in George Clooney's Batman? Because George Clooney wouldn't open the movie for you. You know, yeah. you needed Arnold to be coming in there, going, I'm Mr. Freeze. You know, and all that.
all the bad one-liners.
Oh God. And but they just wouldn't do it. And I'm going, okay, we'll make the movie. So we made the movie. When the picture was finished, Warner's was very pleased with it. I remember they turned around in the screening room and said, how much did this picture cost? And I said, well, it cost, the budget was $21 million, but I brought it in for 20. And they said, how come it looks like a $60 million movie? I said, well, isn't that what I'm supposed to do? You know, and they said, and Shaq is really an actor. And I said, well, there's a lot of print and pickup and a lot of editing genius there to make it work. But they were very, very pleased with it. We previewed it in 60 theaters around the country. It previewed really, really well. Great numbers, perfect for a family audience. And I'm still going, I don't think so. And then the weekend before our movie came out, we had our premiere at Grauman's Chinese, and we got word while we were there that Warner's new picture had just opened called Conspiracy Theory, which starred Mel Gibson and Julia Roberts at the peak of their careers, and it hadn't opened. The Warner's marketing department hadn't gotten it open. And I thought, oh, my God, they got Mel Gibson and Julia Roberts, and I got a nice guy basketball player. I mean, this is hopeless, you know. And unfortunately, I was right. The picture opened the next week, and you could have shot a cannon off in any of the theaters, because when people could come and see it for free, sure. But there was nobody in the movie that could open the movie. And the marketing department at Warner's was fired very quickly thereafter. Bill Gerber, one of the presidents of Warner's, was let go. And a few months after that, I had lunch with Bill, and I said, what were you thinking? You know? And he said, well, up until just before you started production, we were thinking about pulling out Shaq and putting in, like, Wesley Snipes or somebody like the big name, you know? And I said, and why didn't you? And he said, because the marketing department at Warner's came to us and thought they could sell more toys with Shaq than they could with Wesley. And I said, Billy, not if the movie doesn't open. You know, you've done this before, haven't you?
Putting the cart before the horse.
Unbelievable, yeah.
Well, so I tell you what, I had a chance to talk to Louise Jones. She created the character, and asked her about her opinion about Shaq playing Steel. Here's what she had to say.
I think it was very, very cool that Shaquille O'Neal wanted to play Steel in the movie. Shaquille is a huge Superman fan, and I think he loved it that there was a black Superman, that he was a good guy. He was Superman's soul, and I think it was really, really cool that he, as a grown-up, wanted to pretend to be Steel. I mean, that's pretty awesome, isn't it?
So the creator of the character thought it was cool.
That's really nice. I've never heard that, and I'm glad. I was told that they had actually wanted Shaq to play some other comic book character, and he said to Warner's, no, the guy I should play is John Henry in Steel.
Yeah.
And so it was kind of his idea. And I got to say, too, that Shaq is probably one of the most generous, loving guys I had ever met. He was just so terrific to work with. We'd be filming downtown. Whenever we'd break for lunch, he'd go to the nearest school and be playing basketball and shooting hoops with the kids. And he's just a really upright, you know, first class guy. I was excited to work with him, and we're still pals today.
And you gave him a chance to make the free throw of his life.
Yes, I did.
I love it. Come on, what's not to love about that? Go rent it. Get it. You know, download it. Whatever you need to do. Go watch Steel. It's a fun flick. Hey, shouldn't you be retired by now? I mean, you're busier now than ever. Shouldn't you be on a beach somewhere sipping margaritas?
That's not my style, Joe. I don't drink because it just makes me tired and I get sleepy. And no, we're working. A couple of years ago, I discovered something that Warner's had kind of brushed under the rug, that I own the motion picture rights to my original creation of V. And so suddenly when the word got out about that, I had a lot of new best friends. Literally all of the major studios called and said, look, we want to talk. And we did talk to Universal and Paramount and MGM and United Artists and Sony and Lionsgate and New Line. And I mean, literally all of them. And they all wanted to buy the picture or buy the rights to it, right? And I was very nervous, and for really an obscene amount of money. And I kept saying, I was concerned about losing control of the quality. I had seen what happened when other people tried to remake The Bionic Woman, when they tried to make the Hulk movies, which were just, you know, not very good. I am so very, very proud of that I just did not want to turn it over to other hands that might not do it as well. And so I kept saying no to the studios, and this being Hollywood, they said, yeah, we understand. How much money do you really want? You know, and I said, no, you don't get it, guys. I never got into this business to make lots and lots of money. I got into it because I was a storyteller and I'm a director, and that's what I want to do. And I just walked away from all the studio overtures, which were very generous, and decided that we would try to put it together as an independent picture with a budget of about $60 million, which is pretty hefty, and will still be I'll be able to
pretty big that. Independent film.
It's a very big independent film, and that's the struggle of getting it funded. But our desire, and we're still going through the jumping through the hoops of fire to make it happen. But I had to, you know, Joe, I had to make a simple decision. Would I prefer that the movie never got made than got made by the wrong people the wrong way? And I said, yep, you know, and that's what I decided. And so...
Because if it's wrong, you got to live with that forever.
Well, that's it. And, so, the bottom line is if you can write me a check for $60 million, then you can be my executive producer. Or if you can lead me to somebody that has got the $60 million, then you get a lovely finder's fee as well as being executive producer.
What do I get for that buck in addition to your DVD Bionic Woman rights?
practically nothing, you know.
Just a associate producer credit, right?
Not as big a deal. But,
it's V, The Next Generation. It was written in 2008 by none other than Kenneth Johnson. You can find out how the miniseries should have ended. And that's what's in production as the independent film?
The idea is to remake, do a theatrical remake of my original four-hour miniseries.
Nice.
And obviously brought up into the 21st century. But not reimagined. I love that word. It's right, it's synonymous with Titanic and disaster. And, you know, the reasons that the Hulk movies have failed, that the new Bionic Woman effort that they made failed, that a recent ABC attempt to do V as a series with none of my characters and storylines, thank God, the reason it failed also was because they didn't capture the essence of what the original piece had been about. And there are a lot of reasons why the original miniseries of V became the highest rated work of science fiction in the history of television, and still is, and why it had not only critical acclaim but a huge international audience. And so I didn't want to go and try to fix something that wasn't broken. So what we're going to do is V the movie, which will be a remake of the original but brought into the 21st century with new things that obviously were not a factor then, including the internet and terrorism and all of that. And it sets up the two sequels that would be drawn from my novel V, The Second Generation, because there's enough material for two movie sequels. So what we're looking at is a trilogy franchise with one of the most famous brand names in the world. We're close, but you know what? I never believe it till I'm standing on the set and the breakfast burrito is in my hand.
Till Craft Services shows up.
That's right.
Looking forward to it. Can't wait. How can folks find out more about you or even get in touch with you?
Well, I have a website, obviously, which is just www.kennethjohnson.us. KennethJohnson.us, or if you just Google Kenneth Johnson, it usually is one of the first ones that pops up, and that'll take you right to my official website. There's a contact link there. It's funny, when I did the commentary originally for V, that was the first commentary I ever did, was for the miniseries, and I put an email address on there where people could write if they had comments or questions. Beware what you wish for. You know, it's like...
oh my God, Joe, you cannot believe the tens of thousands of emails that I get from people all over the world.
Folks, he answers his emails.
And yes, thank
he
you.
Does.
I always listen. I feel if somebody's going to take the time to write me, then by God, I'm going to get back to them, and so that's what I try to do, and give them the answers that they're looking for, or at least say thanks. And it's a terrific thing because you can really find yourself feeling very, very much more in touch with your audience than you ever have in the past. I've always been more interested in doing theatrical motion pictures, not because of bigger budgets or bigger screens, but because everybody's in a room together staring at a dark wall, you know? And in television, the nights when I was always the most excited was the nights when we had the screening for the cast and crew, not the night that it would go on the air and get phenomenal ratings and millions of people would be seeing it, because I wasn't in touch with them personally, you know, but now with the internet, it's you really have a much more tight connection to the audience, and it's great. And I appreciate my fans and friends that are out there around the world.
Well, I tell you what, I can't imagine a better time, a better way to spend this past hour than by talking to you. Appreciate you joining us on the show today, and just I have this opportunity to thank you for producing pretty much television as I knew it in my formative years. So. It's not often I get an opportunity to thank somebody like that. So, thank you for all those legendary shows.
Thank you very much, Joe. And on behalf of all of the hundreds of talented creative artists and stagehands and cameramen and electricians and makeup artists and and it goes on and on and on. It's the work that we do is certainly not a one man show by any means. And whatever success I've managed to have over the years. Is a direct reflection on all of those hundreds of talented people that have worked with me and made my stuff look a lot better than it ever had a right to.
He's storyteller extraordinaire. He's Kenny Johnson. Kenny, thank you so much for joining us today. We really appreciate it.
Thanks, Joe. My pleasure. Take care.
It's always a thrill to talk with the talented folks who've given life to so many of these classic characters. Kenny Johnson is a true genius storyteller, and as you heard, he's one of the most pleasant and humble individuals you can meet. That was a real pleasure today. My sincere thanks once again to Kenny for spending some time with me today. And I meant it when I said it. His DVD commentaries are mini film schools for aspiring writers and directors. Do yourself a favor. Get those box sets of shows like The Bionic Woman and The Incredible Hulk. Pop in the DVDs. Hit the commentary track. Sit back and learn from the master. And to learn more about the man and find out about all of his latest projects, check out his website, kennethjohnson.us. And to find out about Comic Book Central, we are all over the place. Check out every episode on the website, comicbookcentral.net, or subscribe in iTunes and you'll never miss an episode. And if you're there in iTunes, please take a minute to rate and review the show. Really appreciate it. Got a bunch of new followers on Twitter as well. Thank you all for following, tweeting, retweeting, and sharing the lair. Twitter at comicbookctrl. And I'm also posting some cool stuff on the Facebook page. You can share the lair on Facebook. Facebook.com/Comic Book Central Network. You know, after last week's Dean Cain interview, I had some folks on Twitter and Facebook asking me about some other guests. Trust me when I say we're reaching out to as many people as possible, but keep in mind, if those folks are on Twitter, Facebook, and other social media outlets, tell them you'd love to hear them on Comic Book Central. You listeners are a big part of the show. It certainly wouldn't make much sense for me to sit here and talk to myself. So reach out to those folks, tell them about Comic Book Central. Let's get the word out and share the lair. And speaking about Dean Cain, I mentioned that he's going to be at the Chiller Expo in New Jersey this weekend. Also wanted to mention that friend of the show, Jack O'Halloran, Non from the Superman film series, will be there. And you can also meet a future Comic Book Central guest. TV's Captain America, Reb Brown, is going to be there. So if you're in the area, check it out and keep checking back with Comic Book Central. A lot of great guests are on the way. Well, just like the shawarma scene in The Avengers, we have reached the end. My thanks again to Kenny Johnson for taking some time to talk about those terrific shows that we all love. Next week on Comic Book Central, Kenny tried to make him red, but he stayed green and he was mean. Well, at least he was on the show, but the actor who portrayed the Hulk is as nice as can be. It's the man that made the Hulk incredible, the mighty, mighty Lou Ferrigno will join me in the lair next week. Until next time, kids, have a great week. Keep reading those comics, and thanks for joining me here in the lair, Comic Book Central, where comic books come to life. This podcast is intended for entertainment and education purposes only. All original content of this podcast is the intellectual property of Comic Book Central and is licensed under a Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, No Derivations 3.0 Unported license. All other content and names are registered trademarks and copyrights of their respective holders.
But don't call you Junior, right?
You can call me KJ.
You can call me RJ.
That's right. There you go.